Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
a podcast while walking, and I'm just going to go through just a whole lot of projects I'm doing and a whole lot of software things that I'm doing. The first one is what you would have thought is a rather modest upgrade for while you're walking, and that's to use a interview microphone. So I'm actually walking at night, and just a modest thing I thought is to actually use a microphone, interview microphone. So this has a sort of directional, it's called a shotgun microphone, and so hopefully it'll do things and do less. Oh, gee, it's absolutely freezing cold here. Hopefully it will do things like pick up my voice and start to cancel out the traffic noise and my shuffling and walking, and so it should be easier to hear. Of course, it does make me a little bit of a sight, because I'm holding this long popsicle. How long is it? It's something like 35 centimeters long, and it's got a foam outer, so it's got all these things that's not covered by the by breeze. So just when I was focused on it, I put the I did a podcast, and someone said, "That's dreadful. You know, you talked about what you ate for dinner, and there was all this wind stuff. Get it off the internet." And so I took this to the side. I said, "Oh well, I'm going to improve on certain things. I'm not going to mention what I ate for dinner anymore, although I did have some Chinese takeaway." And I looked at how one could improve overall. And I began to design a microphone which would be directional. And this is by having a series of condenser microphones and having it basically phase amplify. And then I basically designed something which looked rather like a shotgun microphone. And lo and behold, there's one already. So I put in an order, got together, and you'd think this would be rather a simple thing, but this microphone immersively is, and it makes sense, is not stereo, you know. And of course, a shotgun microphone shouldn't be stereo, and that has a whole lot of knockdown implications. It allows you to have half the data rate for 168 kilobits per second. That's an awful lot of stuff. I can't be that much, but per second, you can knock it down to 64 kilobits per second, and so that's got a whole series of things that you one can do on it. And so you set up your dictaphone to go mono, so it sounds okay. And then, of course, you put it in. And you have different bits of software to stitch your dictaphone. The computer detects the dictaphone, removes the sound files, send you sound file which sounds half decent. It will submit to a podcast engine. The podcast engine will automatically cover it with music at the start, and add quizzes and apps and all this U-boot thing, and also do cover art. Now, of course, what happened mysteriously is that when I went to the this different sort of bit rates for recording, I've got to have a real think about this. The encoder to just put the image, the package on the outside, didn't suddenly stop working, and so Now, normally I'd have a crash report, but it was happily writing an MP4 file as a movie format, could easily handle that. But the MP3 format couldn't actually handle different bit rates for the starting music and the finishing music. And lo and behold, it began to crash and just give you the... Yeah, I was producing all these incredibly short files. So what it does is that reports the file length submitted, then the file length in memory. So I've got this car coming past here. The file length in memory as it's ready to go before it's loaded up into the internet. And then it reports the file length on the internet, and if the file length on the internet is the same as the file length at home, it deletes the file length at home. Kind of sort of reboot all of this because the software is there. And of course, just getting a simple microphone led to this tale of destruction. And I had to get in, and I'm surprised sort of how simple the Podomation program is after all the podcasts I've done up. And I then created a selector button 1, 2, 3 where it could put the cover on by LAME software. So LAME is a specialist software in Audacity. FFmpeg is it? FFmeg is another sort of software class, and just can't do it. And then finally, the third layer is don't bother. And so I've left it on the third layer, don't bother. And then I went back and reissued all the files to get down on it and produce it. And that sort of enough irritation, because people can't really understand what you do on a computer, and you're just wasting time on it, and similar like that. And then so that's got up to a certain level, and so that's put a patch on it to allow me to go back and sort of really scratch my head and with proper time doing it. Now, my mother-in-law's in the study, so my computer's out in bedroom. It's all held up. It's rather difficult to push on that particular one. So that's one aspect which has gone through. Now, there's... I suppose there's a series of projects of where it's identified where my memory loss is to go. And it's sort of detailed, high level memory thing, recalling detailed information in the 30 to an hour, 30 minutes to an hour window after it's my ability test to recall. That's down, so I've got to work out a way to crawl back up on that area. But that being said, what it's meant to all this rehab podcasting and stuff like that, it's meant that I've had to really study things more thoroughly to give sort of a base structure to make sure that I understand it and go deeply into things. And it's meant that sort of lo and behold, I've actually begun to actually accumulate a few unusual things, like a sort of semi-robotic podcasting engine, and then integrating robotics into these teaching cubes, and just extending the electronics. And so there's one which is sort of signed off, which is the Einstein de Haas one, which is sort of at the end of the road. There's so that's a cube, and you just simply plug it in, and that's the frequency sweeping out, and the laser comes out of it, and you can see what's going on. And so that's wrapped up. That's basically finished. I can put that on the shelf. There's only a small I suppose, modification for, I suppose, yeah, I really don't want to put a battery pack on it, so it's, you know, it's fully handleable. There's that one. Another one, using bits and pieces of the Einstein de Haas for a vibrating dancing duck. So this is a little duck which dances in the alternating magnetic field. That's just a simple sort of introductory to it. And what I find is interesting that people have got a sort of very much a model of the way things should be without you being there. And so if they have that sort of fundamental model of you proceeding without being there, it's they interpret things and you sort of rip your teeth out listening to it. You interpret it and you go, oh dear. And so the dancing duck is stupid. The Einstein de Haas thing, even though Einstein couldn't do it in 1911, it's out of date. No one's really interested in it. It is sort of like a sort of an objective, sort of expands your width of your experience, so you can encounter people and people, what is it, I suppose they run things down, and you can see that they sort of come in and run things down, that they're sort of, they're not receptive. And this is the entire thing, is that to create a receptive thing, you have to actually put a lot of work in. You've got to get your nose to the ground, your butt up in the air, and just drive along time after time. Now, one of the things that I'm trying to do is this Internet of Things microlab. It's called microlab. So this is one of these crystal boxes. You open it up and you can put your Bunsen burner, everything. It's got sort of scales, temperature measurements, so whatever you want. You know, I'm thinking of just expanding it, and this uses a generic sort of the generic technology of the last couple of years, where you no longer buy individual components, you buy mini boards, and you stick those boards together, much like building a PC, where you've got boards which go into a rack. These are sort of somewhere in between components and the boards, and put that together. And I suppose what I'll discuss here is where I'm up to on that. So it took a long while. Yeah, it's hard to say. The people sort of looking at it objectively saying, oh, look, you're taking a long time to produce this, and you spend a lot of time losing stuff and putting it together. It's all part of the stuff. But what happens is that day after day, although I suppose people aren't really attempting it. So if they're doing anything, say, normally, like, I don't know, stitching a hole in the shirt or digging a hole in the garden, they can do it faster than I can do it. But what happens is, say, I might be able to go 70% of their speed, and that's okay. And what happens is they do their tasks in the sort of 100% speed zone day after day. I do it 70%, but then the next day I've got, say, 10 or 20% of the work from the previous day accumulated to bring forward. So after a couple of days, I'm just sort of slightly equal, sort of compound interest. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. So these boards is quite an eye-opener to sort of look into to the different technologies. So essentially, the boards have basically parameters, which is the power they take, what they can do. So essentially the little micro boards convert analog into digital, then the digital goes to a communication board, and then the communication board has a small programming sort of, I suppose it is a compilable computer on it. It runs a little computer program, and this sort of does some really basic things. So you're scratching your head to work out what's going on. And more importantly, things that you think are boards and are computers, if you don't watch it, they actually have a computer on it. And so this is something which threw me when, with the Einstein de Haas, I had the little LCD display, and I couldn't work out, you know, like if you plug it and unplug it or plug it in correctly, and say if it misses a connection, loses for just a fraction of a second, it gets out of sorts, because what it's doing is it's got registers and it loads in the registers, and it's really sort of a microcomputer. So you can actually, you have to actually boot. So you've got a component, and the component is now elevated to being actually a almost a computer. So this goes on, and there's an obvious thing strategically you want to put this all together with the idea for all these things that you're making it easier for you to teach. You're building these this equipment to enable you to teach, and so I've got to really think of it as I'm being pushed out of being able to teach in the standard area, that you know, does a loss of opportunity of being able to teach mean that doors can open to you, that they then allow you to teach with them? So what I'm sort of aiming for is, obviously, if I want to teach something, I want to take the theory of doing the web work, doing as much computer work, to aim you, can you, I take that to the ultimate conclusion, where all you have to do is plug something in and then teach a lesson from it, an advanced lesson from it. So in this case, taking that as a guiding principle, I have a system that I'm doing an experiment. I don't want to interrupt the experiment to weigh it at various points of time. I don't want to interrupt it, and I want to actually measure all aspects of it. And to measure all aspects of it, it means that those components have to be integrated, have to be battery operated, there can't be any wires or leads with it, and ultimately I've got to get the data out. And there's two forms. Having learnt my lesson, I've decided to go for a bit. I bought the cheapest LCD screen for this next one. I'm buying a slightly more expensive LCD screen. Rather than $3, it's $23. So in US money, that's probably $13 or something like that. Probably wouldn't, yeah, for you US people, that's not too much. But the important thing is that it's using a protocol which doesn't take up 8 wires, and so the $3 one takes up 8 wires and uses up your whole board, and the more expensive one is there. So it's really important for the standalone thing, for it to be working, so you can look and see it's working right away. Now, it also has a ESP8266 chip, and its objective there is to communicate with the outside world. And it's a fairly simple thing. You say ESP Wi-Fi.h, include that, and so you suddenly got all the library functions to do that. And then you just say network password, network SSID, pass it into it, and then you can write write to the internet, you can write to a web page, and once you can write to a web page, it's all downhill from there. That's a very simple thing to do. Now, one of the things that I'm thinking about, the unfortunate thing with this is that it doesn't have a keyboard interface. Do I have to really go this horrible place, which I want to do is avoid Raspberry Pi, but I may have to go Raspberry Pi. The problem is that you have to load a full Arduino code at the moment into this chip. Arduino is sort of like the amateur bandwidth of like anyone can program it. It's not sort of professional industrial programming, it's amateur programming, but you have to have the code, you have to load it in. So you have to do that to load in your local area password and all that type of stuff. So if it's actually got a touch screen and a keyboard which you can plug in, you can actually log in your unit to the local area. Now, the thing is that in schools this is absolutely impossible to do. The security level is such that there is no such thing as a generic password. It's a username authentication, and it takes 5 minutes to do it each time. So at school it's just not possible. However, I was thinking of trying to learn how to do hotspots, and this sort of gives away. So this is where you've got your mobile phone, and it's your mobile phone's acting as a wireless server, so you can speak to it, and then it can use its access to the internet to use that wireless, so you can use it as a hotspot. Unfortunately, I'm behind the eight ball. This sort of gives you away just how slow and behind myself. I can't get my mobile phone on the internet simply because there's sort of a I can't break free loop. There's a sort of very low cost internet provider in Australia called Belong. So that's so the mainstream people have produced an economy stream to sort of fill out the market to make sure that no low cost competitors in there. So for $4 a month you can have your basically a phone. Why wouldn't you have it? And I've got it for my daughter, and it won't allow me to add another phone onto it. It's my time to put on it. It won't allow it to me. So I'm just sort of locked out of that, much to everyone's frustration. And I've put in requests, sort of, it's just nothing's happened. That's part of the being low cost. But that would allow me to have it sort of permanently to the internet. And I've got to really, really think about this next sort of structure. But I do have it hooked up into a local network. Now, our local home Wi-Fi router, blew up, and then a service provider did an inspection and said, look, you need a service call. Of course, the people came out and spent about a few hours correcting faults in our phone line, sort of probably 300 metres from the terminal to our house, and a fault every 50 metres. So they fixed it, and magically we've got an increase of a 7-fold increase in our internet speed. And of course the router is broken, and with these things you just throw them out. And we were going to have to buy another router anyway to get onto the digital broadband. We're on an analog ADSL system, so that's there. So this sort of system has got up, and I was able to send a request, sort of put a PHP file on my website. Just, so this is with your FTP program. You can just, I suppose you can create a file. You can create a file and just open it and edit it. And as you save it, it's automatically saved up there for you. So I was able to write a PHP file. A PHP file actually, unlike a browser which has operations which respond to the host computer and actually do things on your host computer, it sort of opens things and makes noises and lights and information. A PHP file is often is with your HTML file. HTML is referred to the hypertext markup language, refers to sort of the strict style of language, where PHP is sort of like a dog's breakfast of just the worst C++ language I've ever seen. It's just appalling. It's just the worst language. But this particular language executes, it gets variables passed to it and executes commands on the server. So one of the things it can do on the server is write a file, write a web page. So you send a command to it and it will write a web page or append to it. And just to give you a feeling for it, if you, rather than a plus or anything like that, is a dot, and all the symbols are just poorly defined, and it's really hard to do things. And so I was having possibly a week, 2 weeks, where I set it up and I could sort of get it to work from my Windows environment, but when I actually put it into this little ESP onto my little cube station, this tight little chip sitting underneath the tiles which, so I have some bathroom tiles, well, kitchen tiles stuck in this box to form a little lab surface that you can do your experiment on. So I could manually, you know, punch that through, but I couldn't, try as I might. I suppose I spent an hour or so trying to do it. Try as I might, I couldn't actually get any of this to work. And so then I discovered that PHP text files, when you pass a piece of text, it doesn't read the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. It will just only read, can only handle quick, can't handle any space, and if it can't handle it, it sends nothing. It just, the server there, because this, it's not a program language, it's not a program environment, that is, where, say, if you've got a program, software development stuff, you often have error codes listen, and you can actually work out what's going on. Here it just says bad command, and it took me a while to actually, well, there must be a bad command, I must be sending it incorrectly, and so all I've done is replace the spaces with underscores, and so I've just assembled all the data together. And there's a little bit of effort in terms of that, file, command to post the data or send it, I think it's post data it's called, to post the data, is up the top. So you declare these functions, so this is a single word will be you. So the way of C++ or this, the way it works is that you spend a lot of time writing your own computer language. So your very first thing is you declare function, you declare variables, then you declare functions. And so a function is a name, like post data with brackets, and the function is basically, I don't know if it can send back multiple types. A function can return a thing if you say so plus the time of blah, or you can string the date is such and such, and you can have a function which works out date, so it will return. Your function can return a string, or if the function just does anything, it's a void. And then in the brackets you can start declaring things that should pass to the function, and so things that you declare in the function name you can then pass to the function. And so I don't know where it's getting back. I think I only did this back in what you did that sort of thing in Fortran, so that gives you an idea how ancient that is. I probably have not done that since the mid-80s, so I knew what to do there. So I got this going, and passing stuff to this PHP, and the PHP then writes, appends a web page, and just blots it out. And this overall thing is that you've got your website is the actual thing. I have to see this car. I hope you don't run me over, mate. Thanks a lot for that. Are they cops? No, I can't see. So you've got this space. So it's actually rather eerie walking here, because I'm walking down into a valley and there's mists and stuff like that. I've just got to really give it up. So it writes up. You tell it something, and it will create a website for you and append to that website. And then you can look at that website on a browser and see it's there. And of course, you then have the horrible thing of do you want to have a system which cleans up the web as it uses the information and wipes it off the web? Or how do you actually want to operate like that? So on the tube level, you have buffers and serials and buses and stuff like that. So you've got the architecture on the component level. You can actually expand this up onto a global level and have your server acting as a buffer, just storing there. So normally, if you've got serial read and write between two objects, they will obviously, what will happen is that you'll write a serial word. It won't be waiting there to what, what do you want to eat for dinner tonight? P, I, Z, Z, A. It's got to be able to pull it all together and convert it into words, so there's buffers and stuff like that. So this overall architecture you can just expand up to the internet. And so on the server, I have it just write these web pages, and once it writes a web page, that's all over Red Rover. I can then just say download the web page and just extract the data. There's no one of the things you don't want to do is actually get in there and sort of ape electronics with software. Have the little software buffers in your stuff and it's all live. You want your software to be there, and if it doesn't work, you rebuild it until the data is permanently there so that you can look it up. And also, if you've time set all your data, you can then what I call a directory. Put it into a directory. You can put other forms of data there. So, say if you are conducting an experiment, you have your mobile phone, and you have an app on it, and you write comments. You just read comments into it as things are going into it, and then this lab view down the track will actually get your data and festoon your data automatically with comments. So it does all the lab for you. And this is just a general strategy of using your strategy of building the electronics server and just expanding it up, using your standard of keeping a lab book where you just take down the data and then analyze it separately. You don't try and do two things at once. So this is basically the web as a lab book. And you generally in your lab book you have a space for comments. Well, similarly here you can just keep comments on your mobile phone and you'll automatically upload it and put it in the same site. When it's constructing the graph, it will automatically put hotspots on that graph, and so as it produces a graph you can press a button and it can say, oh, I tipped it over here, I did this over here. So that's the time stamp. So that's essentially what you want to do. Now, what I try to do is, this structure of, if you browse a website, it will give you the website at the point. Now, there is this thing where you can update websites, and it's always live update. So, particularly if you you can have your software polling the website, and this is the entire thing to not your website to slowly update the cricket scores without going white and all that type of stuff. I haven't worked out quite how to do that, and I was using iframes and stuff like that to copy a website over. Obviously not to do it. It's a whole new generation of, I think it's HTML, XHTML, something like that, to be able to do all this. These are sort of dynamic websites. So you've got the static, and this is an area of software I haven't got up to. But still, that doesn't really answer the point that once I've built one of these Internet of Things, I want to build many of them. And so what I want to do is have my data stored, and the device has in the data automatically, as you put on the device, it creates a subdirectory for it. And so I have two separate devices. Where the data is, the device name. And then this next section is that this big amorphous file where it's got no control of the data. So what I've done is I've just, up to this stage of getting the PHP to make the file name just the date and time. And then I had to go through PHP, and it's not intuitive at all, like completely not intuitive. It's sort of set time zone Sydney, Australia, but Sydney, Australia is written with certain capital letters in the right places, capital A, capital S, and stuff like that. Sydney / so Australia / Sydney with a single quote mark on either side, and so back, sort of like there's sort of like no logic to it all, but it goes up. And so that sets the time zone marker in there correct. And so you have a file, and then I've used that to, with date and hour, to actually write your file. And the thing is now to actually write the file into a subdirectory of the device. So your device has a directory, and the directory has these files, which I think will be about a megabyte each for an hour of data. Is about a megabyte each once a second. Record everything, and this is obviously not for live stuff. This is for data recording in a lab, and you can have it live. It can sort of poll some data as it's going through. And so then over a 24-hour period, it should now be clicking over. Every hour it starts up a new file, and just puts the time and date stamp in there, and then all the data nice and clear, and you don't have to fuss about anything, especially with LabVIEW. You just have string detect, and it just, you know, you say your variable and your time, you know. So, oh, well, I think it will go via line. I suppose that might be the best thing to do. It just takes it up, dumps it, and makes it all very accessible. Now, the thing is that, what you want to do, so I've now got that up, so it's now, so if you want to actually look at this, it's Glenbrook Institute, all one word, .org, so Glenbrook, Glenbrook, Institute, Institute, .org, /test, and then you'll see files sitting up there. Files are the will be the in under test. There'll be date, yeah, the date and time, hour, and the hour will be a 24-hour clock. I think it was 9 o'clock, so it was writing 21 in there. How's that? 9 and 12 UMH, 21, and it will just fill it up. And so if you have your... Now, the other thing I'm going to have to do is put a little switch on this, so it's sort of rather eerie, like you unplug it from your computer and it's got a mobile phone battery there. And I sort of went for a cheap, you know, a sort of lower cost battery, but it's not, and I think the battery will last about 8 hours. So at night, you've got this cube. Now, fortunately, my wife can't see it because she's blind, but it's a this cube, and this cube's there, and the light's glowing blue. This is really quite spooky cube, glowing blue, just so it's energizing, and then it's got a little red lead on it, and I sort of feel half that it's just part of the beautiful style involved here. Now, I'm just going to do a quick walk tonight, so I've just slowly come down to the bottom of this gorge, and it is just absolutely cosmic. Now, the problem is it's there's sort of mist has come up, and we're just really coming in on this here. So we're up to the stage of doing PHP, and what you want to do is to pass it, needs to pass it to the PHP engine, and it's got to say the device it is and the data. And now so whatever it is, so it's just got to send a string, and it's got to interpret the first part of the string as the device, the data, and what it has to do is it's got to create a subdirectory for the device. Now, this is something I'm not, you know, this is something which is ripping my, this is where someone who's actually studied PHP properly can actually say, ask the question, if there is not such a directory, make the directory. So that's just going to be a tour to vomit. So it makes the appropriate directory. So if the file, if the device name doesn't exist, then write a directory for the device name. And then if that directory does exist, don't, you know, if it doesn't exist, make it. So once it's make it, it then has to actually then load the file into that data for that device. So this is your generic input, and you know, lo and behold, how do you actually get, you know, I've sort of tried, I sort of wrote a directory and then put it in the subdirectory, didn't work whatsoever, and because you look at it, and of course the backslash is used something else in PHP for division or not pipeline or something. It's just insane. So you have to actually write out dot in capital letters, the whole thing. So there's no rhyme or reason for it. There seems to be no way this operates. Yeah, file separator. So I've got to go in, and that will, I think, you think, oh, gee whiz. So this is really hard. So I've got my friend Peter Turner, who, he's the alleged sort of central expert on this, and I write to him, and he does look at these things, but by the time he writes, so I just really wish I had someone who can actually help me out on that, a web page. Oh, I should possibly. It will cost nothing. Nothing to start to show these people these types of things, and if they could help, you sort of really want to help because you get sort of bored doing it. And so once this is done, the lab view. So the entire thing of a buffer and a serial, a buffer on a bus. Yeah, that's the general idea. But of course, your architecture for a device is bus and architecture and reading and stuff like that. On the internet, it can be completely multi-level asynchronous. So you can have one computer, so with one device or multiple devices putting up there, and multiple computers doing whatever they want to do, and the device, the data is stored in an area, and so that's a much more powerful way of getting it done. So hopefully I'll produce that, and I suppose, as I said before, there's the problem of people there's sort of social ritual where you have to actually sort of brown nose suck ass to actually get your idea up. You ought to wine and dine people, do all this type of stuff. And so if you haven't done it, there is this natural thing to people to say, look, this is not necessarily normal, this is, oh, that's okay. It's it has rained a lot today down here, and I can see it hasn't flooded here, but see if this creek is passable. There's a little ford, and yep, okay, you're coming to that at the moment. So that's the software blues today. One is the Podomation software not working. It just, so a small microphone does something. I'll have to, you sort of look at different paths going up. And of course, doing mono is giving you twice the stereo is a factor of two in your file size. You wouldn't think of it. There's that, and then slowly getting through. So it's taken probably 2 hours, and it sort of makes it absolutely unpopular. Now I'm going to finish this off by actually doing a soundscape of the actual water. I'm going to point the shotgun microphone at the creek so you can possibly hear it, and then I'll switch off. So thanks a lot for listening. Podcast on the science fair and teaching kids sort of scientific method, and the sort of major thing is that people think, I've just gone to the science fair, I'll describe it to you in a little while, and the major thing is that the kid had to have a hypothesis and test the hypothesis, and that was the kids' scientific method. This is Peter Hill as I go podcast while walking. I'm sort of quite pleased that I've got this shotgun microphone, but it's definitely a great investment. Now, the problem is that I'm at the bottom of a gorge, I'm walking up, and so by the time I reach the top, I'll be absolutely knackered, and you'll hear this sort of breathing, poor person. The interesting thing is that before my heart operation, as I was sort of out there really struggling, it would I'd do this walk with a dodgy heart, obviously, and it would take me a quarter of an hour just sitting at the top, just heaving, trying to get air in, because I didn't know what the stuff was, and sort of sore chest and all this stuff. So this is a joy going up here. So what happened is that I have a 11-year-old son. They have a science fair, and they had solid, liquid, and gas, and there was possibly 60 primary school students all standing in front of their individual experiment, and it had to do with solid, liquid, and gas, and of course that's something of intense interest to me in terms of people, you know, what is a solid, what is a liquid, what is a gas. That's an important aspect of it, and the idea of temperature changing and various things like that. And so you've got open interpretation, and people picked out various experiments, I suppose, that they wanted to do. And what I want to do is emphasize the hypothesis and possibly an alternative way that I've thought through doing experiments. Now, one of the things is I'm going through cognitive rehab. And what that means is that the memories slip away from you all the time. You have to redo them. And it's sort of like, I suppose, where people can actually just get a spray paint and just graffiti ideas. And they're sitting on the wall. Mine fade, so I have to keep on going back and restructuring them and resketching them. So there's possibly an advantage on that. Now, obviously, at a high level for me, it's solid, liquid, and gas. For me, it's crystal, glass, and gas. And the crystal, or the different state transitions, are different entropy states to across, and there's the I suppose gas dynamics and the physical properties. So gas is compressible, gas and liquid can take a shear force, and a solid can take a shear force, and a gas will take up the volume of a container and have a pressure differential, and so will they'll all have pressure differentials, and gas will take up the volume of the container, whereas a liquid will take up the volume of a container up to its liquid level. As a solid will stay there, and there's transitions between all these things. That's very interesting. And my son was looking at ice cubes melting. How long does it take? Ice cube melting. Another person was looking at how different liquids spread. A lot of people were putting Alka-Seltzer tablets in water and having some sort of oil on top, and the Alka-Seltzer would make the water contain gas, and so the water would be lighter. So it wouldn't be a gas bubble, there would be gas bubbles going up, but the water would have some carbon dioxide in it, and this would form a lava. Someone had a really good experiment, which I really thoroughly enjoyed, which is food dye in hot and cold water, to see how that evolved. I sort of really like that in many, many ways. There's someone who had isopropyl alcohol and had a very high pressure, so it had a very high as you increase the pressure, you suddenly release the pressure, let the gas out, and it would form a fog. I sort of really, I really like that. I suppose one of the things that I suppose concerned me is a little bit is that people mistaking clouds, thinking a cloud is a gas, all those sorts of things. But they all were drilled in basics, which is, you know, for 11-year-olds that they should have a hypothesis, which is a prediction, and have one variable and test it. Now, I don't know. You've got, I suppose one of the things that I really got used to in the industrial environment is a multivariate analysis. So if your product had a process which produced, say, a two- or three-dimensional array of variables, and your quality were produced, you got different qualities out of it, you could, it's just impractical to define a variable, and you get frontier analysis, and yes, that's an important thing to do. Now, I suppose the really important thing for this is this data analysis and frontier analysis is what you should do in education. But you've got your class, you've got a test, and the test can produce a single result or can produce a combination of results. So you give someone an essay, short answers, and multiple choice on different topics. That's a multivariable test. Now, you can make it a single variable by adding it together, but you can actually do a lot more by recognizing what the data is, making it multivariable, and look for frontiers. Of course, this is not good for the kids. And they were saying what their hypothesis was. Now, it was good at this stage that their hypothesis is a guess. Now, the trap, I feel, in secondary school is that the marking guide they give for people is, do they have a hypothesis, and what is their justification of the hypothesis? You know, what's the reasoning behind it? Now, not as two separate things, but a hypothesis should be a guess with a reason. And actually, that's not very good science, because, I predict my lunch goes missing because Sally always steals it. Oh, I'll put it out here, and it means that you complicated your thinking process. You prejudice it with a reason rather than having the reason separate. So I did see a few hypotheses there going across. And one of the things is reading the history of science. you have people not, what is the history of doing experiments, scientific experiments? And this is where I think it's probably a good thing to actually put yourself in a historical context as you do all these things. And so a lot of these methods are really, like, we have grown up as civilization, we've sort of invented school and authority before we've invented individual scientific method. That is, there's Aristotle, there's God, there's Jesus, there's all these big people, sort of folk knowledge, and they come across, and then you have this set of beliefs which are not founded in experimental science or testing, which go up, and you're saying, well, quality knowledge is getting good quality people. It's all about quality people. And so it's reading the right language, reading it from the right people. Sort of like getting your news, you know, I get good quality news from such and such channel. So because I'm that sort of person. I drive a Volvo, I watch state TV, and I read stately journals. Doesn't necessarily mean you're there. So this type of hypothesis with a reason is in fact the what exactly was going on with pre-scientific experimentation. So you've got Mytholdrake who basically poisoned everyone to get into power, and then realized that he had to find antidotes because he would necessarily be poisoned. So if he had antidotes, I don't know when it was, this is I think before the time of Christ, up around the Black Sea, and he was a poisoner, and he poisoned his own people as laboratory experiments. When he captured Romans, he poisoned them, and he would give multiple poisons and basically find the right recipe. And essentially, he sort of didn't quite know what he was doing, but by taking poisons, gave himself an immunity to it. It's all completely batshit. You know, what he's doing, unethical and unscientific, but enough for the Romans to be convinced that he was onto something, as evidenced by certain things. And you also have to understand in this age that people would, in the Middle Ages, would be trial by fire. Trial by, could you, if you were innocent, you could put your hand in boiling water, and if you screamed, you'd be killed. And so there were various saints who could do this sort of thing. So this is all sort of crazy, crazy things. And the sort of the secret aspect of crazy thinking is that you're not socially powerful enough. One of the aspects of crazy things where you have trial by fighting. So if there are two people and they disagree and they fight, the person who dies in the agreed fight must have been wrong. So like this sort of, so a lot of people, when they buy the wrong thing and it works, they adjust their values to fix all the time to make what they do appear right. So they can get away with a lot of, what is it, badass behavior. And see, we should have just come out of that. You can probably hear me breathing. So a lot of people have this sort of sad discord. So a lot of people have this way of thinking, especially if they're unethical, a little bit dishonest. They can think that it's not dishonest if I'm not found out. It's not dishonest if no one has ever seen it, and I can somehow stop people questioning it. And so this is where scientists who say, scientists begin to uncover, unplug this thing, they're got rid of the science. Now, they're not science because I hate the scientists, the silence, because that's how you make something wrong right. It's like there's nothing solid, it's all collective communal belief. And so that's really what was happening in the Middle Ages. You had sort of levels of discussion. There's various sort of three levels of ancient reasoning, which are in this bubble of social coercion. So you have the three levels of Greek learning, and this is the dialectic. So dialectic is basically learning from watching TV, learn from watching plays or listening arguments. It's sort of scholarly. It's not at all scholarly, you just get into it and think about it for a while. Then you have rhetoric, where you have to actually, you've got your view at the barbecue, and you test your view in the fires of discussion. And so this is sort of like, if you've got an obvious fault, you can actually do it. It's sort of like you got a bomb of a car, you take up to the mechanics to see if the mechanic will let it through for roadworthy. And of course, you can pay some money to a mechanic, you can actually do the mechanics yourself. And so rhetoric, so dialecticism, so which is this insanely poor quality thinking, which is unfortunately the thinking behind communism, even though I think you've got a lot of good thoughts, a lot of good things, and it's also the thinking behind Donald Trump. And then again in rhetoric, if I can tweet and I can do, if I can just smash the opposition, so Donald Trump is on the arrow there, then you have logic. Now, of course, logic at its finest can only go so far from the basis of there. You know, it's logical if it's A and B and stuff like that. And of course, the Middle Ages is fantastically known for this doing deductive logically, that if all A is true and B is a member of A, so therefore B is true. Now, there's often faults in this logic, and Aristotle used logic, and you write out what he wrote in these very long circular arguments. So if I assume, let us assume something to be true, work through it, blah, blah, blah. What I assume to be true is true. Yes, it's a sort of the basis. So you can actually write out these long logical arguments with maths, Russell and stuff like that. So this is what was going on, and this dialecticism, this is where you... So I'm going to have a problem, and I'm just going to think about it as hard as I can and come at it with the most mature, beautiful way of thinking of a problem. This is basically the day. It's a, what is it? At the end of the day, it's a, not a circular thing, but it's a lot of these things have, into it. I'm just going to have this little break here, partly because I decided to look at my dictaphone and found that it was unplugged. So there may be a minute or so there with the sounds got out. So why I'm talking about the Middle Ages and basically uninformed, what we would call scientific simpletons running the show in the Middle Ages, is that I hate to say it, that's what primary school teachers and the primary school, this is society in general. So what you find is that people often Look, being a scientist and pedant, you're going to irritate people, and people are going to like you may be at the end of an experiment, a series of well thought out arguments, or you may be in the middle of something. Someone will walk in, not caring, and they have this, I suppose, attitude that I've got to get on to my next purchase, basically. And this is sort of separate from the environment, this sort of immediate environment, the people who really don't understand science. Then the next environment around that are people who have very short loyalty, attention spans, and a sort of a resilience to go through things. So I think you can sort of see with me, with experiments and stuff like that, this long resilience, especially if you've been listening to podcasts for a while, you can see that, I've gone in for a long while. But this sort of contrast, someone who has got a lot of money, wants to go down to the mall and demanding service, and gets bored easily. You sort of buy something, In a certain sense, people are poisoned by wealth, and they can't think clearly because they never have any time. They live in a high demand, high stress, high information system, and they are rewarded by being fickle. They've been rewarded by not being loyal, not being constant, but to get their loyalty, you have to pay the money. You have to pay things, and they're not loyal to a brand. If a brand doesn't satisfy them, they don't care. They're not going to spend analysing simply because you can buy technology so quickly. You can buy solutions. You don't have to go in and actually understand why something doesn't buy, it doesn't work. And you've got the entire advertising. If you look at advertisements, people are the advertisement is basically, here's so-and-so with a problem, here's the problem solved, here's another customer jealous of that person who hasn't bought that piece of equipment. So not only do you get satisfaction, but you also get satisfaction plus status. And all this is in 30 seconds, and of course there's no understanding and logical, and that consumer being. So if you have the ancient church making the suffering saint who bears witness to it, so the ultimate idea of a Christian soul, someone who can bear witness and relate to your consciousness of another person, that is someone who will listen, befriend, do it, that's off the agenda now. And if just, your poor shop assistants have to go in, and every customer is always right, but ultimately there are so many arseholes out there. And we're living in the time of arseholism. So if you can imagine, these poor kids are sitting with people who really don't understand science, who are living in the time before science. So what is the time of science? And that's one level. And then they're cocooned with a whole society with TVs and fast things where the view is that the power goes to the person who can actually play with loyalty and have a short attention span, so you can be with it. Sorry, that's a bit cynical, but you have Archimedes and a few people like that. You've got Euclid, a few people in it there. It's just around the time of the Renaissance. Did you have the idea that there is such thing as a social store of knowledge? That it's not that knowledge is right or wrong, it's actually an item, a socially created thing, and that social thing is like a feel, is like any other product, and it can be, it's, it has a life, and it can be stored there. Now, you can obviously, you look at Archimedes, he did experiments and stuff like that, but the sort of systematic idea of doing experiments to teach others, that the experiment should teach us things, didn't really come across to the Middle Ages, and not the Middle Ages, the Renaissance. So you've got sort of inklings of this beginning to work a little bit, and like it's slowly coming on, and even Newton, it's not on proper, you don't have the full experimental rigor. Newton is actually sitting on the cusp between Renaissance and Enlightenment and the Middle Ages. He is in many aspects a Middle Ages person. You've got Galileo's Dan, who started to do systematic experiments on strings and music, and he put this across to the idea of Galileo, and Galileo did a lot of experiments to come things, and he began, people began to, the idea of the printing press and society, the science sort of came across with, I suppose the printing press may be one aspect of it, to write up the communal aspect of science, but even Galileo did certain experiments, but they're within fixed things, so he believed that didn't have Newton's law, he actually believed that things would travel in a circle, and that's what Aristotle said. Newton says things would travel in a straight line, he believed they would travel in a circle, and anything else he got really angry with. And of course these people didn't have scientific candor. If you disagreed, you disagreed violently. These people had a lot of emotions in with their science, and so this, the birth of science has emotion with it, and we're now dispassionate. And of course, I don't know, this is a recipe for disaster here. But the critical person who really kick-started science is Francis Bacon. And I sort of mentioned to someone, oh, look, I think it's Francis Bacon which came up with the a new grade of scientific thinking, but got us on the road from deductive thinking to inductive thinking. So deductive thinking is what you would use in grammar and law and stuff like that. Inductive thinking is, I do not have the sufficient knowledge to deduce from, so I'm going to propose this knowledge and do reverse engineering to see whether it's true or not. So I'll propose something and do anything. And for that, you have a hypothesis, a guess, and then so your guess if your guess would be contradicted by their process of what you propose, then your proposal is not true. But the actual mechanism is you guess something for fear of favour, and you test whether that prediction is true. You actually don't need, so that little mechanism is sort of a subsection of this advance from deductive to inductive thinking. So inductive thinking was proposed by Francis Bacon in great detail, and the methodology and the social aspects around inductive thinking was also described as a dual logical social invention. So he actually described a society which is the foundation of the Royal Society and our scientific societies across. So although hypothesis is very limited, hypothesis is just a prediction. You don't actually have to say, when you're testing hypothesis, the actual logic of why it should work can be assist in your experimental design, but you don't have to tell anyone what it's going across. And associated with the invention, scientific invention, there's the social invention of the scientist. So this is sort of there, but here people were taught, I suppose, hypothesis, you know, what's the reason? I think it will melt because blah, blah, blah. So the one thing that inductive thinking doesn't do, that hypothesis doesn't get you to the because stage. If it doesn't happen, that proposal is in dire straits. If it does happen, that proposal could be could be there, but that proposal can only be knocked down. So your hypothesis, you have to test whether your hypothesis is true or not. But what often happens is that your test is true is not rigorous, because may work one time or may not work again. It may not be significant. You can test something with it, such as that, say, this ice cube will melt faster in these conditions. You can, and that's your hypothesis, that I put a ice cube on a black plate, it will melt faster than, say, if I put it on a ceramic plate or something like that. And your prediction is there. Now, reasoning can only be reasoning which is hypothesis nullification proof, and then you can add theories and go on your deductive thought and embellishment and stuff like that. Now, so hypothesis induction is a way of knowledge growth. So you have knowledge refinement, which is Sir Thomas Aquinas, where you say, is this knowledge good or is it bad? And you can chuck out knowledge. So deductive reasoning ultimately pares down the applicability of knowledge, so your knowledge contracts. Now, inductive reasoning was a method by Francis Bacon to grow science, and the idea of science, the basis of science, is the growth of knowledge. And there are a lot of things that we do which are scientific in nature, but are not the growth of knowledge. This is the growth of the bond of knowledge. The growth of information is another thing. So if I see something and I do a test, that test will tell me something, refine the information by using deductive knowledge. So I can do a test on you and I can deduce some information, I can generate new information, generate new knowledge. So if I am an electricity customer, I can do a test and measure the amount of energy that you've done, and so I can take A plus B and generate new information. So I now have the information about you of exactly how much energy you've done. So there are reports to discover and prove and guide, but hypothesis is about generating new knowledge. Now, so your hypothesis refers to new knowledge, but for anyone, for anything, system, new knowledge can be defined as what is not already known. Now, that can be for a society, it can be for a group, it can be for an individual. And one of the things that we have to do is we say, as an individual, we're going to consider that you don't know these things, and you can practice inductive logic with hypotheses to set up a model, and you can be a model of scientific thinking. So there's accepted models, and you have to actually get mastery of your own intellect. If that makes sense. So inductive thinking can operate at the big level, or can operate at the minor level, as a method of directing and informing and growth. So there's reason of that. Inductive reasoning is part of healthy knowledge growth. So you got this entire hypothesis thing, and whether people are doing a true experiment or doing a demonstration. It's older people. Or doing a demonstration, and there can be just observation and deduction. That is, I have a hole, I throw a rock down, I don't hear it make a sound except for after a minute. I throw it down, it's all silent, and then I walk around and it goes pop. My God, it's a long way down that hole. And I haven't done a hypothesis, but I've been stimulated. Just new information can be pulled up, and I can stimulate. So a lot of things that you really should do is, before hypothesis, is just do random experiments to see what you want to do. And you can have a hypothesis with no logic. You can say, I hypothesize that as I get older, I'll be able to throw further. So that's an experience. That's a prediction. It doesn't necessarily grow knowledge, but at the end of the day, it would confirm your knowledge of what you... Your quality of knowledge would increase personally. So there's that aspect. So now the conduct of this hypothesis stuff is from Hume, English writers and stuff like that, from Francis Bacon, that area. Science has come a long way in that we now have the double blind. Oh my God. So these modern cars are pretty amazing to listen to. Okay, so hypotheses have come along a long way, because we now have the knowledge that my observation can be really beset by optical illusions. There can be social illusions. There can be just such a strong desire for something to be that my perception can be totally distorted. And so we have got this certain way. And so you've got things, people looking for gravity waves, quantum effects, which now believe you have to have an understanding of maths, which is beyond your accounting level of school maths or anything like that. So having looked at it, sort of looking at that, I had to restructure. I said, I know I don't feel comfortable with this hypothesis. I know these kids are making mistakes. Of course, you wouldn't say that. And I know that these teachers have the impression that they are teaching genuine science, because that's what they do. They pick up a book and they teach. Well, they teach without fear of favour. And so what's sort of happened to me is I've sort of had the reset button pressed, and so I don't have confidence in what I believe, but that's sort of the ideal thing for a scientist. A scientist is actually not confident. So, like, you have no need for deductive or any sort of logic. If you think you know everything, you don't need to be a scientist. If you have the ability to not know anything, or if you don't need to know anything, if you're a bully and you can get what you want by just hating and undermining people, you don't need to be a scientist. So in general, there's a few bully scientists, but in general they're sort of there's political people who can decide what they want to know and all that type of stuff. But in general, you don't have to be a scientist to push this up. Now, I was just thinking at this point in time, at the side, I was going to give one punchline for this. I was thinking at this point in time, my computer is a bit unstable, but now I've got a chip which is speaking to my modem, which is stable, which is speaking to computers in the US. And so even if my computer should fail, the data will be stored. Isn't that sort of lovely, lovely view that this is the real Internet of Things, the real power of it? Okay, getting back to it. If one looks at gravity waves or CERN, where there are thousands of scientists, so thousands of, and you have to withdraw competition of friends, you've got the press, which has not moved forward scientifically, the press does not understand science, you've got all these factors involved. Has science evolved from the time of Francis Bacon? And I think the answer is yes, but we haven't culturally adjusted for it. So I've come up with this model of 4 P's, 2 S, multiple choice, an answer and further questions. Well, really a starting off question. So you have your starting off question and a preamble to actually put that question into context. So if I say, why is toast brown? There's a preamble that there's a big deal in my life. My family gets really upset if I don't give them perfectly brown toast, and it's something that's always worried me. It's just, you know, a preamble is really a mezzanine floor to connect your scientific experiments with your audience. It's where you put in, suppose it's an introduction. Then there's a pattern. And so the pattern I propose is that as I turn the knob on the toaster, it'll get darker. I propose this general pattern. It's got this general trend. Now, I propose the trend, but then I break it up into two things. Now, I propose that there is this trend to know about it, and then I sort of embed in that doing sufficient data that my experiment can then go on to extract information. So when it's extracting information, it's no longer in the inductive phase. It's doing something else. It's measuring, ascertaining things, doing it. So you can create information or ascertain information. So I can sort of go outside and estimate your power usage, or I can actually go in and ascertain or know your exact energy usage. And then if I add that information plus the information of the price plan, I can create new information as new bill. Now that all there is sort of a secondary stage, but the actual experimental stage is proposing the general pattern. Then the next P, the third P, is the path. How am I going to get there? So that would be method considerations. That is a pattern. Then the picture. So I get a picture, which is generally a graph. So I describe a pattern, and I see if I can generate a picture, which is the pattern. Then all these things is really the healthy thing of what we have to try and de-educate these kids, because rather than actually saying hypothesis significance, right, you means that you set them up to just pour scientifically from grade one. You then start looking at the significance. Now, the first one is the numerical significance, that which is corresponds to reliability. So, have you actually do you have any form of timing? Have you, how significant is the feel? Have you done the right things? And then there's the evidential significance. So if you start off with toast, cook it, and then put the same toast back in, the what you're doing is not evidence of it. So these are these things which sort of pare away and argue, that is, refine what that picture matching with the pattern means. And then there's social significance, and that is in terms of is this information significant? Like if you find that the toast goes lighter and as you cook it more, and you, this is a social problem for a number of reasons. So this is just to allow other forms of significance to get into, allow people to discuss it. And then you have a thing of not whether your conclusion is right or wrong, but how significant your picture of the pattern is. Okay, this is not a conclusion. This is significance. And if it's all very significant on all things, go and publish it. If it's not significant evidentially, go and redesign your stuff. If you redesign the experiment, if it's not significant. So if it's all your significance, your quality factor of your logic. And that's really a better thing for giving this binary conclusion, no conclusion thing. It's this binary thing which is really, it's a poor reading of history. And then the next thing is that you're in an educational setting and you want to crystallize your knowledge in context. And the way to do that is a multiple choice question. Is it a, if I put the toaster in, do I get darker if I put a higher setting, put a lower setting, put no setting in, or colour it in with the texture? All those things, which one of those things? And then the answer is a way of getting a very succinct discussion and answer there. But it also allows people to read the question, one, then the question and answer, because people tend to, I don't know, the way that people browse and go through mobile phones, this is what they want to do. They want to get the pay dirt. Then, once you've done that, so you've got the significance and the context of it, you are then ready to write the answer. Your initial question and your answer. And then, obviously, further questions, but this, or what if that? And if any of those are reasonable questions, someone else can come along, and before you learn is that's like every experiment is a paving stone, and you can tessellate group experiments in this method. Now, the entire reasoning is that rather than actually get involved in history, where history has examples of large sections of people who are not scientifically literate, large groups, societies for which science doesn't work. We are living in an age where you've got Donald Trump and, you know, denying global warming and digging up coal and stuff like that. All this entire thing about being unscientific, and part of being unscientific is, If you're not scientific, you're either very, and you're happy and wealthy. That's because you have sufficient power to not need to use science, and that unfortunately only goes for one or two people up the top. And there's a lot of people who can't use it, and are comforted by people who can't use the science. So that's the. The fair, and again, I just do really think about me myself getting on top of this cognitively. So I'll just check that my dictaphone is on. Yep, and I'm at my home now, and I'll say good night for you. Good night, and I'm off, hopefully, doing a combination of things, and this is having the tenacity to keep on plugging away, having the openness to include everything in it, and the humility to think of a new way of doing it. It is a profoundly humble person who's not connected with society who can possibly think of a new way of doing it. And hopefully you as scientists out there will do the same. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.